share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me?
It is 12:09. This is WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm John Williams. There's Pete Zimmerman, our producer, and we appreciate your tuning in. You can call or text. We don't take many calls during this program. We've got a lot of guests lined up for you, but I'm interested to hear some of your feedback. If something you hear requires your thought, question, or comment, 312-981-7200. I'm looking over my shoulder. We're downtown Chicago. We're in the 18th story of an office building that has a pretty good view of the city and the sky. I said a little while ago that it's not raining downtown. It's raining lightly, but not nearly as hard as it was. And a little while ago, Demetrius Ivory told us that we've got more weather in the forecast. More storms are possible. And he said, as much as you might want to see the sun to peek through, if that does and it really warms things up, maybe more than the forecast, then that means the storms are going to be worse later this afternoon and this evening. More thunder, more lightning. So if you don't want that, root for cloudier skies and less sunshine. Next week, better than the end of this week, he said. And just before the break, I was talking with the president of Bradley University about their plan to reopen that school. And I was recollecting that for a couple of semesters, I taught a communications class there. This was years ago. I was not much older than some of the students. It was something I always wanted to do, and I really enjoyed it. Good kids over there at Bradley. But I was moving along fine with my class and ran into a couple of things late in that first semester that I thought, wow, being a teacher is harder than I thought. Here's one of the things. A student who was not a really good student in my class and just didn't want to be in that class. I don't think any of them weren't bright enough to pass the muster with me, although I was so ambitious. I found that I was giving quizzes and making assignments that they thought really weren't necessary for a, you know, low-level broadcast communications class. And they may have been right. I had more enthusiasm as a teacher for the first time than they did as a college student, taking what sounded like an interesting course in the syllabus. I was all in. And some of my students weren't. And one kid who wasn't doing very well in the class at all, I told them that your final paper, and you had an option of either a final paper or project, will count for a high percent of your grade, like 40% of the grade or something like that. And one of the kids who was flunking turned in a brilliant paper at the very end of the semester. And it was going to boost his grade up to something really much higher than the work he'd been doing all semester long. And I didn't believe that it was his work. I mean, I'd been reading his assignments. I knew how he operated in the classroom. And this was far superior vocabulary and writing and research. It was before the internet, really. I had no way of checking it. So I just called him in and I sat him down and I said, I don't think you did this. I think somebody else did. And he looked me right square in the eyes and said, this is my work. And I said, well, then how do I reconcile the fact that all semester you've been slacking and now I've got this really thoughtful paper here? What am I supposed to do? And he just shrugged. And I just shrugged and I didn't know what to do. You know, do I flunk him or do I give him a B or a C because of this stellar work that he did at the end? And I had no history to know how to handle a thing like this. And as I recall, I said, I'll give you a chance to do another paper or another project, which maybe wasn't fair to him. You know, I think a more experienced teacher would own this decision point and make the call instead of putting it back on the kid. But that's what I did, and he did not turn in another paper. Another time, a student who was an average student was going to get, I think, a low C in the class, and her dad called me up one day, and he said, listen, if you give her a C, she's going to not have a high enough GPA, and she'll get kicked out of the sorority. If she gets kicked out of the sorority, she won't like school, and she'll probably drop out of school. If she drops out of school, she won't have a fruitful life. So I really need you to make it a B instead of a C. And I did not. And in retrospect, I don't know if I made the right decision. And I'm sure she's not in jail today. I mean, she was going to Bradley. But again, I just had no experience to know how to handle something like this. I called a senior teacher there, that is a teacher who'd been there longer than me, and I said, what are you thinking? He said, it's kind of your call. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things now, I think I would have just said, oh, it's my attitude today is it's okay, really. It's not that important. My class, I'm not even so certain that a college degree
You should Google her. Do you remember her name?
No. I mean, if she had maybe made more of an impression on me in class, I would have, but she wasn't a great
student. Find out which women's prison she's in.
I could look up her number. It's tough, I think, because you are in there as a teacher. This is just my limited experience, and anybody who's been a professor, high school or grade school teacher, knows this more than me, but you're all in. And then somebody sloughs off, and you think, well, what am I doing here? And now you want me to hand you the grade? Like you could. The class is not that hard. It's broadcast communications. It's 12:14 on WGN. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. You wouldn't know that yet, but we're about to get to that. The texts include these: John, you're innocent until proven guilty. You should have given him the grade. The next text says, you sound like the worst teacher ever. I was not. John, you wouldn't believe what teachers deal with. It's my 20th year. It's an amazing life. John, when I was in junior high school, I was a complete jackass in my physical science class. I was failing the class. The teacher did not like me for good reason and told me I needed an A on the final even to pass the class, which he said no one had ever done before. So just to spite him, I studied and got an A on that final. John, give everyone an A. They tried to play you for a better grade. Jeez. John, those two stories hurt your reputation with me. But a couple of you have said things like, John, you did the right thing because it's the integrity of the class and the students that someday will appreciate that you held them to that standard. So there you go. That's why I don't want to be a teacher. Ian Schur joins us, editor-at-large, CNET. Visit CNET.com. Hi, Ian. I trust you're doing well.
I am, and I'm glad that I never had you grade my papers either.
I'm trying to think of what I did wrong here because the kid was cheating on the final, and I said, you get a chance to do it over again. The other kid was getting a low C, and it was not a hard class. And then the dad calls up and says, will you fix that for me, please? And I said no.
That I don't agree with, absolutely.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I'm sure you got good grades. Ian, did you get good grades in school?
I did. I started off pretty average in high school, and then something kicked in, and I started doing well, and then I got through college pretty well too. But if I'd, if I hadn't had that kick that really got me going, you know, I probably would have had pretty average grades, and you know, that would have affected my ability to get into school and keep going and turn into what I've become.
It is an amazing and sometimes beautiful thing to, for whatever reason, see somebody suddenly see the light and go to it, and now they're working hard and realizing their potential, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Ever since, Twitter is making work from home a permanent change for their employees. Is this right? They're not going to go back to the office at all?
They're not. Well, it's not going to be all of their employees. They're still going to have an office. They have a very expensive one in downtown San Francisco. But the thing that they're saying is that they realize that the nature of the world has changed and that the employees, a lot of them, might be uncomfortable coming back into the office. You know, there's a lot of discussion now about how, you know, a lot of Silicon Valley companies and the world at large have embraced these open office plans, and that seems like the worst thing to have in the middle of a global pandemic.
Yeah.
So Twitter has decided that instead of having to lease more office space so everyone has 6 feet of distance, they're going to say, hey, why don't you decide if you want to work from home? And if so, that's fine. And I think more tech companies are going to be open to this because, frankly, it helps with some of their office space problems, but also I think that there's a lot that was boiling under the surface before where employees were enduring these grueling commutes. I had one friend who had to be on a bus for 2 hours just to get to her job and then 2 hours to get back every day. And talk about miserable. And I think that a lot of people, if they were offered the opportunity not to have to commute like that, would take it in a heartbeat. And Twitter's, I think, deciding that that's what they're going to do.
I wonder from an employer standpoint, from the company standpoint, what's optimal? People intermingling in the office, exchanging positive ideas. You know, there's something to be said about the group dynamic, or people working from home where sometimes they're more productive. They have less fraternization, and a lot of people drill down at home. I wonder what's best for the company.
at the moment, the indications are that people are more productive at home, and that a lot of what these companies used to believe, which is what you brought up, right, the idea of people being together, seeing each other, ideas kind of naturally flow out of that. There's a lot of research that's been done by, you know, the University of Pennsylvania, Harvard, Stanford, all sorts of people who have shown that that theory hasn't actually played out. And more often than not, people lose time from either fraternization or being distracted by what's going on in the office, because these open office plans mean that people who are not particularly quiet characters like myself interrupt, you know, people's thinking process and whatnot. So I think that's part of why things have changed. And for what it's worth, I've seen studies out there before this whole crisis began that showed that the expectation was that something on the order of 40% of the American workforce was going to be working from home in the next 20 years. And I have a feeling now that's probably going to be an undercount. And that was before this crisis emerged.
Mm. Are Facebook and Google doing something similar?
They are kind of doing a similar thing. So Google, well, Facebook is known as probably the least willing out of those three to allow you to work from home. And Apple is probably the least willing. They are such a secretive culture that they're really not comfortable with people working from home. But generally speaking, I've spoken to a number of HR representatives from all of these companies. And when I wrote a story on CNET about how they're handling parents during this thing, and, you know, the schools are out, the parents are having to work full-time and manage their kids and how they're handling that. They all said that they're more flexible. They're willing to be more flexible nowadays than they would have before this whole thing started. So I'm curious to see how that ends up. And then, by the way, you think about the San Francisco housing shortage and all of that. If these companies allow you to work from home, what's to stop me from moving to Montana? And as long as I have a good internet connection, I'll just work from there, and I'll pay a fraction of what I would in San Francisco. And that's, I think, the next step in all of this, is allowing employees to get out of the incredibly expensive area that is the Silicon Valley.
Yes, and I don't see why the company would push back on that.
I mean, I think that they're going to find that they don't have to build out these enormous offices anymore, that they are able to save on a number of things, including the cost of the food, the cost of the transportation for the employees, mm-hmm. and also they're going to retain people easier. I mean, that's a big thing. A lot of companies I've found in the years that I've written about this stuff, and I've spoken to Dell, I've talked to HP, I've talked to Microsoft, I've talked to Apple, all of them seem to miss on some level the cost of hiring new people and training them, which is substantial. And if you can convince people to stick around, you're going to be way better off. And I think that this is, like I said, been bubbling under the surface for a while. A lot of people are sick and tired of paying ridiculous prices in all these large cities and want to move out to the suburbs or even to the rural areas. And why not, as long as they have good internet?
It's just amazing that one day the world was operating one way, a switch got thrown, and now we're all imagining a completely different world in so many different regards. You know, I'm thinking about...
Yeah, and I think it's good for us all. I mean, I think that having talked to a number of employees who feel, who before all of this felt like they had lost their lives to their work, and we're thinking about leaving the tech industry altogether, now they feel like they have an option and that they can stay in the jobs they love but also be able to live a life. And, you know, I don't care what your job is. I think the idea that you have to decide between having a normal life and having a job is an unfair choice. So it's good to see these companies start to come around. I don't think it'll be fully, but I think this is a beginning.
Isn't that why the Googles of the world have ping pong tables and sous chefs, so that you'll work
yes.
all day and night there? I mean, it's a great perk, but it's also so you're kind of captive in the corporate culture.
It's an acknowledgement that these grueling work hours are so hard on you. And And, you know, I think that for a long time, it was also a recruiting tool, right? We've written on CNET about how Facebook actually hired the Michelin star chef from Google to be their chef. And, you know, we've seen this type of stuff over and over and over again. But what's turning into this is that, you know, now we have an unlivable situation in San Francisco where housing prices are beyond what pretty much anyone can afford, and it turns into a mess. And this might be the way out of it while also still keeping their headquarters and keeping things running the way they expect, is that we've been forced to be all remote, and they saw, oh, it actually kind of works.
Just, I mean, the ripples are fascinating, aren't they? So maybe there's an exodus from the Silicon Valley, and people's and the values of properties start to go down in some of these inflated areas. Or maybe there's a housing boom in Montana because people can work there and still make the same amount of money. Talk to me about this. This is fascinating, too. This is at CNET.com. It was your colleague Queenie Wong's story. Facebook tackles coronavirus misinformation, hateful memes with AI. I could understand them looking for words, but how would AI surf out wrongful information about the virus?
Yeah, one of the things that has always been tough for Facebook and Twitter and all these companies is that they have tried, you know, there's more posts that come onto Facebook and Twitter and YouTube than there are human beings on the planet, right? So there's way too much stuff coming on all the time. You can't reasonably be able to watch for it all. You can't pre-read or decide whether or not it's good before it posts. And so what they've decided to do is try to train computers to identify a lot of it. So, for example, Microsoft built a program along with some other people called PhotoDNA, which actually, if you give it a photo that you know is bad, will say something like child exploitation, it will be able to find it anywhere on the internet and then warn you and then remove it. That system has been incredibly successful on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. It's part of why we don't hear very often about it, is that they're automatically able to remove it. Well, it doesn't work as well for misinformation, right? Because oftentimes these things have a tinge of maybe being newsy, or they come from an authority figure, like a world leader, or something else, and it becomes incredibly hard to pull it back. So these companies are really struggling to be able to stop stuff like that Plandemic documentary, which, if you haven't heard about it, we have a great story on CNET explaining the science of it and why the discredited scientists in that documentary is wrong on a lot of points. But it's really hard to deal with that in real time. And millions of people were seeing stuff like that while they were trying to figure out, oh, can we remove it, should we remove it, and all of that. So that's what's interesting about all this, is that they're trying to train these things to be able to stop it, to train a computer to identify it and pull it down, and we're not anywhere close to that yet, but someday they think they can get close.
Ian Schur, editor-at-large, gets an A today as the CNET editor.
You're
over
too kind.
No, I don't think I am. It's nice to talk to you, Ian.
Take care.
At CNET.com. Lise Glink joins us. She's regular. Let me hit the button so we got you on the radio. Lise, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Good. Real estate and financial wellness expert. She's the owner of Think Glink Media. Also, check out Best Money Moves and ThinkGlink.com. So the market's actually got a little bit of an uptick today.
Yeah, it was down about, I don't know, say 400 or 500 points this morning, and now it's up 226. So, you know, your typical coronavirus swing, as we're calling it.
Man, some days it's not worth the time to try and figure it out. It's sometimes they're reacting to what the Fed did. Sometimes they're just reacting to something the president tweeted or some hope from a pharmaceutical company that things are going to get better. And then the next day it could change completely.
Absolutely. I think we also have to remember that the Dow is 30 companies, and that's certainly not a total reflection of what's really going on out there.
Unemployment numbers are shy of 3 million. Is that worse or better than they were expecting?
That is worse. So economists were widely expecting around 2.5 million. And let me just say again that while that number, 3 million, is a lot better than the first few weeks of this, and it's better than any week since, It's terrible by comparison to any other week since they've been keeping these numbers in the history of the U.S. So 3 million is not a good number. I don't want anybody to think that it is.
Yeah, fair enough. The Federal Reserve chair made some comments about a prolonged recession. He's just laying it out there. He's not sugarcoating it.
He's not. And I really appreciate that he's brave enough to say that. And that is with the Fed having taken what is, by any stretch of the imagination, extraordinary measures to help support the economy, with the government having spent over $3 trillion already. We probably need another infusion. And even though companies in many states are now getting people back to work, hello, Wisconsin, neighbors to the north, we're still seeing a mass amount of unemployment, and we're also seeing people who can't even file because the systems are still so overwhelmed in some places. So I think everybody's a little unsure of what the numbers are, but the Fed released a report this morning that said that 40% of households with income of $40,000 or below had lost their jobs. And that's just a profoundly huge number.
Think about that. A sector of how many people, $40,000 or less, that's so many of us. 40% of them have lost their jobs. Who knows for how long? Hopefully shorter than longer. Terry Savage was on with us yesterday, and I've never heard her so discouraged about the unemployment system and trying to get people their checks. Are you suggesting, Elise, that in fact, whatever these unemployment numbers are, they're underreported because people still can't get through the system to claim unemployment?
Exactly. I do think that they're underreporting. I think when I talk to people, John, and I know you talk to a lot of people too, and I bet if you opened up the phone lines, what you would hear right now is that everybody knows somebody who's either been laid off, furloughed, which is like being laid off because your income goes away, except you might get your health insurance benefits, and you might be called back to work, but laid off, furloughed, or pay cut. Every single person I've talked to is experiencing one of those three things. And it doesn't matter if you're earning, you know, the big bucks, your six figures, you've been asked to take a 20 or 30% pay cut. Even in necessary worlds like hospitals and healthcare systems, even there where we need every person we can get our hands on, they are furloughing people, pay cuts to all the top senior leadership of very serious amounts, 20, 30, 40, even 50%. And you're seeing workers' hours getting cut. So it's just a very, very deep and serious problem. And when you think about going back to work and, okay, well, so you're just going to go back to work and everything's going to be fine, it takes a long time for that all to sort of restart. And if you think about where we were 12 years ago, it really took about 7 or 8 years for the economy to get over the malaise of the Great Recession and then get into what we all were thinking about in December as being the best economy in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it almost makes you wonder why the markets aren't doing worse, right? I mean, we plummeted, we've crawled back up, we've sort of plateaued, we're playing in the same area the last few weeks. And then these economic numbers keep coming out. It's just about how the economy is going to languish for a while. But the market doesn't seem to be staging the second half of that W that I think that a lot of people say it's going to do.
Right. I think we have to just disconnect the stock market from reality, because over the last, I would say, even 15 years, what we have seen is the Dow just kind of almost at the whims of the computers that are trading behind it, as opposed to doing what it's supposed to do, which is sort of giving us an eye of where we are going to be 9 months out. So if you just say, well, where are we going to be 9 months out? What the stock market would be telling you today, by being about 15% below its high, is that our economy has only taken a 15% hit. But I think we can all of us look around and say, yeah, that's can't possibly be true, because we've already been closed more than 15% of the year, and there's a lot of fallout from that. So just stop looking at the stock market and start talking to people. And I think when you start hearing about people going back to work, consumers are coming back, people are spending money, homes are starting to close, you know, people are buying things, selling things. When you start to hear people talking like that, I'm going to start being encouraged about where we are.
One last note, negative amortization loans. What is that and why is that on your radar today?
The other day, our president said that the U.S. should accept the quote-unquote gift of negative interest rates. And we've had negative interest rates now in Europe and in Asia for a while. And basically what a negative interest rate is you put money in a bank, and basically they give you less back. There's no interest that you're earning. In order to just keep safe some portion of your dollar, they're going to keep a piece of it, like a fee. That's a negative interest rate in action. And it's hard to imagine how that would help, because negative amortization loans got us into trouble in the Great Recession on the home buying side. And if you start offering negative interest rates on savings, I just can't imagine what kind of a signal that's going to send to the rest of the world. So actually, Jerome Powell, the head of the Fed, said that he was staying away from negative interest rates. So let's just hope that that all passes by as one of those tweet storm things that, you know, seem to come and go now and again.
Elise Glink, thanks for joining us today. You can check her stuff out at thinkglink.com and Best Money Moves, as well as Think Glink Media. It's always good to hear you. Thanks, Elise.
Thanks, John.
It's time for the WGN Radio Business Minute.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily rundown of Chicago area business news. TikTok has blossomed during the pandemic, but the app, popular among teenagers, is facing a lawsuit in Illinois. Four unnamed Illinois minors, represented by their parents or guardians, filed suit against TikTok, saying the app has violated an Illinois law protecting people's biometric information. That dinner party between Uber and Grubhub might need a side of Pepto-Bismol. There are antitrust concerns involved. Cranes points out that Uber Eats and Grubhub are number two and number three in a four-way race among online restaurant ordering and delivering companies. DoorDash is number one at 35%, but the merger would give Uber Eats more than 50% of the market. And the good news while you're staying home is that you aren't paying tolls like you used to. Of course, that's bad news for the Illinois Tollway Authority. The Tribune says April revenue is down $52 million. That's more than 40% below expectations. I'm Steve Bertrand. That's the Wintrust Business Minute.
Yeah, no kidding. Back into the newsroom, Steve Bertrand.
600-point swing for the Dow today. It's now up 174 points after a dive this morning. The Nasdaq in negative territory, down 9, but the S&P 500 up 9.
This is Orianne Samuelson with a look at the agribusiness scene.
And the numbers on the agricultural futures trade at the Chicago Board of Trade today. July wheat down a quarter of a cent a bushel. July corn down a penny and a half a bushel. July soybeans down half a cent a bushel. Hardly any movement in the prices at all. Chicago Mercantile Exchange, livestock futures, June lean hog contract up half a dollar a hundredweight. The June live cattle contract down 42 cents a hundredweight. And the May feeder cattle contract is down $1.32 a hundredweight. China making news today. We do have conferences continuing, virtual conferences. One of those held yesterday, the BMO Capital Markets Global Farm to Market Conference. And at that event, the CEO of Archer Daniels Midland said he remains optimistic that China will meet its slow pace of buying so far. And he said we'll get over the recent criticism of China by President Trump. Lower commodity prices due to the coronavirus pandemic may limit the value of China's first-year agricultural product purchases, but Luciano said it's a two-year agreement, and we'll see where it goes. And he had no sooner said that than we did get word U.S. exporters inked their first soybean oil export deal with China in nearly 2 years. USDA said private exporters reported the sale of 20,000 tons of soybean oil. And yesterday, the USDA reported three sales of soybean products. First of all, the 132,000 tons of soybeans to China, another sale of 66,000 tons of soybeans to China, and then the sale I just reported on soybean oil. Let me close this report with something that showed up on my computer screen today that makes a lot of sense. It says there's not a meat shortage. It's just the big meat processing plants that are closed. So here's what you do. Number one, team up with a few friends. Number two, contact a local farmer and ask to buy a steer. Number three, have the farmer deliver the steer to the local butcher. Number four, the butcher will call you when meat is ready. And number five, you pick up the meat and pay the farmer and the butcher. This way, you keep the local small businesses and farms going, and you end up with better meat. That's your money on 720 WGN.
Business reporter Amy Guth joins us on WGN. Hi again, Amy.
Hey, John. How are you today?
Pretty good. We were talking with Lise about a couple of things that I think are on your radar, too. And was it Twitter or was it Facebook that you were thinking about?
Gosh, I mean, I usually am thinking of both of those things on some level or another. You know, lots of tech companies making lots of interesting moves lately, for sure.
Yeah.
But
pardon me, I know what it was. It was the unemployment numbers that the two of you were looking at. What were you seeing when you looked into those?
Yeah, that's certainly, you know, every Thursday the Department of Labor releases more of that information. And today we have learned that an additional 3 million people filed initial unemployment claims last week. Now, that number is a seasonally adjusted number because there are, you know, there is an ebb and flow throughout the year where we have a normal expectation, kind of a predictable curve. So adjusting for seasonal times there, we're seeing another 3 million filed. So that brings it up to 36.5 million since mid-March. That represents 22.4% of the March labor force. So that labor force shrank in April as things continue to worsen. But what we are seeing is, you know, we saw that first initial big spike of first-time unemployment claims, and that's gone down a little bit. So, you know, there's still some optimism that maybe the worst of those first-time claims are behind us and that it will be people continuing to refile benefits as they remain unemployed, but as maybe more people at some point will start going back to work, we'll see that number shift.
McDonald's has got some new conditions by which they will open up their restaurants, I guess, across the country, maybe across the world. It includes everything from the conditions in the dining room to the conditions in the bathrooms. I always thought McDonald's was pretty clean top to bottom, but I guess everybody has to find a new level of clean now, huh?
That's right. And I've been really watching this closely because I think this is really interesting, especially in the hospitality sector, how companies are adjusting. We've seen Marriott really quickly say, hey, this is our plan for how we're going to help people feel assured that we are taking this seriously and that we're really taking sanitizing very, very seriously. So Marriott came out with a plan. Hyatt did the same. Now we see this from McDonald's. So what they're going to be doing, they're saying they're going to clean the bathrooms every 30 minutes. I'm like you. I've always thought, oh, you know, there's always a sign on the back of a door that says last cleaned by so-and-so at whatever time, and it seems pretty much in order. But they're going to really kind of double down on that. This will impact all 14,000 McDonald's in the U.S. That's a lot that they're rolling out all at once. And the challenge with McDonald's for anything that they're changing, adding to menus, things like that, is always supply and demand because they need a big supplier so that it's a uniform solution across all 14,000 of those locations. So they're going to do that. Workers will be required to wear masks and gloves, and they will deliver food to customers' tables in a double-folded bag. But also, customers in most locations will be using kiosks. We saw this big investment in technology over the last year from McDonald's, and we're kind of waiting with a little, like, I think investors were kind of going, okay, what's the payoff now? What are you going to do with that? Here's part of what they're going to do with that. They're going to be using these kiosks, so it's less contact with people. They'll clean those kiosks and then deliver that food in a bag to the table.
Well, that's the key. They got to clean the kiosk because I'm doing a lot of kiosk or remote purchasing, either punching in a code for my credit card or doing something like that, and we're all sharing the same kiosk, the same touch pads. So some of the instances I've been at, Amy, they're doing a good job of keeping those surfaces clean, and some they have no interest in that at all. that's the key. I'd rather give my order to a person across a counter than touch a mutually shared touch screen unless they're doing a good job of keeping those surfaces clean.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I think it's been really interesting noting how stores are doing this. I've seen some retail locations that have, many of them, especially supermarkets, have put up really quickly these kind of plexiglass clear shields. Some people, there's still a little spot where you can use your debit card and use that. But yeah, you touch that keyboard, that keypad to enter your PIN number, things like that. I've seen a couple of stores that kind of has a give and take where you step forward, swipe your card, step back to a marked spot, and then the cashier will bag up your things and hand it to you. I've seen a lot of different solutions to that. So it'll be interesting to see how this happens and what other fast food chains do to respond to this and how they do it. You know, I think then the next thing that will be important to watch is restaurants that are more dine-in focused, less fast food, more, you know, casual dining, even up to fine dining, how they respond. You know, I think there's been a lot of conversations so far about maybe spacing tables out, having more open air dining, things like that. But until we really start seeing the, how that is in practice, it's going to be really, really interesting to see the things people try just to try to get their businesses back open again when state orders have been lifted.
I was at Home Depot yesterday. They only let 50 people in this gigantic store in Chicago, 50 at a time. They count them as they come and go. And I counted three people who were doing nothing but cleaning, a person standing there with disinfectant. And as the escalator was going, they simply had a rag on it, continually disinfecting that. Other people wiping things down. It's so hard for them to maintain cleanliness or our confidence. And yet credit card purchases where you just stay at home are off more than I thought they would be.
Yeah, I was very surprised by this too. So JP Morgan Chase, which is such a huge, huge bank, they're reporting that U.S. customers for credit card spending fell by 40% during March and early April as compared to last year, which is really interesting because you think, you know, people are home, they're spending more, you know, they're buying online more than they're maybe using cash, things like that. I think it's really just a matter of spending overall being down. Particularly, we keep an eye on the credit sector, the credit area of the economy, just because that can tell us a lot about economic health. You know, when people stop using credit, when their payments are delinquent, you know, banks are watching that very carefully. So it's interesting to watch that data. But I was surprised by this number. I figured it would be down. I didn't think it'd be down by 40%. It's mostly, you know, goods and services, retail, restaurants, entertainment, of course, because people aren't going out, things like that. Grocery spiked, as I think that probably makes sense, right? A lot of people are suddenly going, okay, I need to buy 5 things of flour, 50 things of yeast, right, and all the bottled water. And then, so we saw that first spike, and then that kind of fell back down a little bit. But, you know, I think what we have to also think about is yesterday, you know, there was a lot of conversation from every pundit from every walk of economic life talking about remarks that were coming from Jerome Powell, who's the Federal Reserve Chair, talking about, you know, things, saying numbers like, hey, for people that make less than $40,000 a year, 2 in 5 do not have work. Like, they lost their job. So they're, you know, I think that's a big piece of it, too, as we're comparing spending numbers and you know, discretionary income. If you're making less than $40,000, there's not a lot of discretionary income to begin with there. So these are all kind of pieces that we put together when we're kind of keeping a pulse on the economic health of a nation and what's going on. Of course, if, you know, here in the U.S., such a big portion of our GDP is about consumer spending. So, of course, when we're seeing numbers go down, even if it is just in the credit area, that tells us that GDP very likely will contract.
Amy Guth reports on business for WGN Radio. Thanks for your help today, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.